On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we react to the news. Rob Manfred saying that the ABS challenge system is in all likelihood coming in 2026. What does that mean for baseball? Do we like it? Do we not? And we talk about the White Sox ownership news. Jerry Reinsdorf finally announces he will be selling the team, but not quite yet. And then, of course, it's Friday, the good, the bad, the ugly. And most importantly, Jake tells you what happened in the Red Sox-Yankees media game. Did he get a hit? Tune in to find out.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that barreled up a baseball at the house that Jeter built today. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and yes, this episode will have a review of the 2025 Yankees-Red Sox media game, which I know all you listeners are eagerly waiting for.
Oh, and if you're watching on YouTube, you're going to be treated to one heck of a video of Jake Mintz taking the swing of his life. But we are not going to pamper Jake's ego too much at the start of this show. We will save that for later on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. We have a couple big pieces of news that we're going to dig into, and that is going to be our opener.
Tap your head, friends. ABS is here. Automatic ball strikes system is coming to MLB in 2026. Probably. Almost certainly.
Rob Manfred, the commissioner of the sport, spoke this week and gave some very clear intentions about the league's desire to move to the automatic ball strike challenge system. Let's be very clear. This is not full-blown robo-umps where the umpires are merely just standing back there and signaling whatever's coming into their ear. No, this is the challenge system that we got to watch at the major league level for the first time in spring training this season. And while there is technically this 11-person competition committee that has to review potential rule changes, it appears that there are enough people on said committee that this is in all likelihood going to happen because Rob Manfred wants it to happen and the league gets to kind of make rule changes almost whenever they want now. Now, that's almost a separate, bigger conversation. And as we know, over the past few years, we have seen a lot of changes to the game, some of which have been awesome, some of which some people don't like. We've grown very used to a lot of these being very normal in our sport, whether it's the pitch clock, whether it's, you know, the rules about pickoffs, whether it's extra innings, automatic runner, all these things, we're just like, yeah, that's baseball now. And it's possible that if we introduce the automatic ball strike system, that in 2-3 years, well, yeah, that's baseball now. But I think this is a pretty massive, in some ways, maybe even the biggest change we've seen yet in a lot of ways, and will truly alter in some ways how the sport is played. I really do believe that. So Let's get into this. We did get to watch this in spring training. We saw it in person. Not that we watch a whole lot of spring training, but it was happening multiple times a game. And so they got player feedback and we have data, which is also fascinating about how often players were right in terms of challenging balls and strikes in their first go at it. But when you first hear that this is coming, not that this is a huge shock based on how the league was talking about it in spring training, where does your mind first go?
I feel a need to remove and separate what I prefer and what is best for the sport. Okay. So personally, bad home plate umpiring does not bother me. It does not. Maybe that is because I played bad Division III baseball and the umps were even worse. And I watch big league umps and I'm like, they're pretty good. Right. Maybe it's because I'm not cheering hard for a team and living and dying with moments late in games anymore. But for whatever reason, a ball that's like two balls off that gets called a strike doesn't make me mad. At the same time, I understand why that does frustrate fans who it's like, hey, bottom of the ninth, like we got to get this right. And I see why it frustrates particularly team employees and players and coaches and staff. players and coaches and staff generally, like especially front office, are amped about ABS. Like, this is something that they're looking forward to significantly. For me, I don't need it. It does not take away from my viewing experience of watching a baseball game. It's not a problem right now, in my opinion, right? How do you feel about it on a very macro level?
Yeah, so it's so interesting to me because we are kind of having two different conversations. And I think the way that the league is approaching this is also compelling. Because one of the reasons that I brought up as a positive for ABS is that it could, in a lot of ways, enhance the entertainment of the sport. Not only will we hopefully be getting more calls right that are obviously wrong because you're giving the players the opportunity to challenge, but sometimes those moments are entertaining. And if the whole point is that this is all entertainment and it's fun to watch, remember, if we think about some of the other rule changes that we've had, it isn't necessarily always about like what's the most fair or what's like the best, you know, objectively purest game. It's about making the game more watchable, whether that's the league trying to get more balls in play. Now, a lot of those attempts have not worked, whether it's, you know, banning the shift, stuff like that. But of course, chopping half an hour off the game, right? Improving the pace, adding more stolen bases. Like those are things that the league is trying to.
Yes. Sure. But those were problems that they fixed. I think this is less that, right?
Well, why
I think
not?
A lot of people. What's the problem is what? Bad umpiring?
Yes, which again, I agree with why and me don't care about it as much. But that is a huge thing that bothers fans. But the question is, and we aren't going to be able to answer this when we talk about this today, will this actually fix that? Okay, yes, you're giving the players pitchers, you know, catchers, the opportunity. Hitters, right?
That's
not
it.
Not managers. Which is important.
Which is good.
The opportunity to challenge. You're going to get to a game. You retain them if you keep it. But you look at the data. It's not like they were overturning 90% of the calls. It was a little over half. You know, catchers had a little bit more success than pitchers, I think. Or catchers had more success than hitters. I know catchers had the most success of those three groups. But the point is how much are you really solving this? This is an opportunity, a way to go about it that's not full-blown robot umps, which I think we're certainly happy with because I'm with you. I still like the human element of the umpire being part of the game in some respects because in some ways we see it in the other ways. We know that the umpires are also better than ever, which is kind of why it's ironic that we've arrived at this place because we know for a fact that the zones are being called better than ever before, and yet we are still going to introduce something that is trying to make them even more perfect or at least correct them when they are not perfect in the moments that we care about the most.
I will retract what I said. This does fix a problem in the same way.
It's attempting
those
to.
I am skeptical that the entertainment value of a challenge will not just be a novelty where in 5 years, a tap of the head in the same way that like, it was a novelty in the first year we had replay review, and now it's a part of the game that I don't love.
Sure.
I mean, it's worse in college, obviously, but in pro baseball, I don't watch a game. I'm like, heck yeah, replay, right?
Obviously agree with that. I mean, the difference here is this should take, I think, on average, 10 seconds.
Way quicker.
You know, so that is a key difference. But I do agree with you. It's not that it's necessarily enhancing it that much. It does add this is what I'm, I think, most interested in as we start to process what this is going to mean and how the league is going to respond. Because on one hand, the league can say, oh, well, we just let you test it for all of spring training. Like, you're going to be comfortable with it. But we know for a fact the way that players and managers and teams were treating it this year was, I'm not going to take this that seriously. I'm not going to think about this from a strategic standpoint. One, because it's not relevant for us this season and we're trying to prepare for the season. And two, because spring training is not real. And this is going to be true next year, even if they do know that it's coming. And that is what I'm really interested in, is that we really will never know how they are actually going to treat this until it is in the regular season. That is scary and fun.
They didn't have it set up at every park. And so certain teams got to experience it way more than others.
Yep.
And so it's just not, they need to have this ready to go in every spring training facility for next year. And I imagine that they will.
100%.
I want to be very clear about something here. That this is not full robo umps. I think that is a very important distinction, right? This is not pitch happens, umpire gets a buzz in their pocket if it's a strike, calls a strike. That doesn't exist
in the minors.
Yeah. That was tested. It got pretty low reviews from players because of how it fundamentally changes the sport, the way pitchers pitch, the way catchers catch. If you're going for the rule book zone and you throw a curveball up in the zone that nips the top, that is technically a strike. That is not a pitch anyone throws. That is not a pitch that anyone at any level that below the big leagues will ever throw. And I think that is important to understand here. What I like the most about the challenge system is that it doesn't alter baseball development from the bottom up, right? If you have full robo umps, you're changing the way that the catcher position is structured. You're more willing to like, okay, if Rob Manfred said full robo umps next year, I'm like calling Kyle Schwarber and I'm like, hey, I want you this offseason to see if you can like try it out back there, right? Now, pitchers still need to throw and there's still an element of game calling and receiving. I understand that, whatever. But it would lower the bar significantly if we had full robo umps. And I don't think this is going to do that. I really don't think this is going to do that. And I think that's a good thing because the human element of watching a catcher frame, I enjoy and I think is interesting. And then the human element of different umpires having slightly different zones, I also find interesting. The idea that, oh, we got, who's the tall guy? The 6'7" guy?
Jordan Baker.
Jordan Baker. Got Jordan Baker back there tonight. Gonna have to adjust slightly. Every day is different. I think that's a compelling aspect of our game. If I was the hardball czar, I would probably, and I could just choose, I probably would not do the challenge system for my own personal preference. I understand why it's being implemented. I'm excited to see it, and I'm very excited that we're not doing full robo umps.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And I think that while I agree with you about the developmental point that if we're not just completely eliminating receiving, and I'm glad that that's true, there's still a path towards learning how this works. Now, it's going to be on a smaller sample, and it's going to be way more subtle, but you can imagine a situation if this might take multiple years, where catchers do understand this pitch is more likely to be called a strike, or I have a better chance of challenging it in this spot because I understand where this robo zone is. And you know what? That's fine. If we're talking about a couple pitches a game and catchers can learn that, I'm compelled by that.
Yeah.
You know, then there's the whole other element of is Laz Diaz getting challenged into the ground?
I want to talk about this.
This is compelling too.
I was at a spring training game. I think it was Tigers Phillies. And Laz was behind the dish and he got challenged way more than any other spring training game I was at because he is not a good umpire, right? Like his home plate zone is really bad and hitters know that. And so they're over challenging him on the assumption that he's wrong, but he's right more than they think. And so I would imagine that the worst umpires will have some of the higher challenge rates.
I agree. And I think that's fascinating, but I do still think that is what I am most curious about. And I'm repeating myself now, but we just aren't going to know because players are not, there's probably going to be teams. Again, we did not get this year. Sure. They understood how it felt to tap your helmet and look up at the screen and like functionally the act of challenging and seeing it go. And like, that's really what it was. It was entirely a test drive. The functionality and the execution of it in a real major league game that counts, we don't know. And I don't believe we're going to know next year either because spring training is not real baseball. It's not the tension, the leverage, the who's pitching in what order, that doesn't exist. And teams are not going to suddenly start treating spring training like the regular season just so that they can prepare for the challenge system. That is why I am, again, there's no good way to do that. Sure. But that's what's going to be most interesting if we do in April next year, what this really looks
like. So that's next April is going to be lit, dude. Next April is going to be fascinating to watch. Yeah. And I would be curious to see data, maybe this is up and I missed it, of are more strikes becoming balls or are more balls becoming strikes? because I would imagine that part, this is maybe a little bit of a theory, that part of our goal here for the sport, right, is to see more pitches in the zone. We want more pitches in the zone because in theory, that's going to lead to more contact and more balls in play and a more entertaining product. So I would imagine that MLB has some sort of data that zones tend to expand beyond the rule book more than they contract inside of it. And so this is going to lead to more strikes overall and hopefully induce hitters to swing more often or make more contact on pitches in the zone. That's just the theory. One last strategy point, and then we can wrap this up. If I'm a manager, I am forbidding almost all of my pitchers from challenging, like blanket rule.
Yeah.
Now, I would make exceptions for, like, you know, Max Scherzer would probably, like, shiv me if he didn't get to challenge. You know, there are certain pitchers who would be pissed about this, obviously. And certain guys you maybe would trust enough to let them make challenges. But if you look at the data of the pitcher success rate versus the catcher success rate, there's going to be a huge gap there, and there was. And that's because pitchers are biased, right? They're like, I threw that pitch. That was a strike. Catchers are at least one more step removed from the object. There's a more objective perspective from the catcher compared to the batter and the hitter to go along with their vantage point is better. They're back there. They're the closest to the umpire. They are not just near, they are the strike zone in a way, right? Like, they're right there. And so if I'm a manager, nah, we're pitchers, we don't do this. We let our catcher do it.
So unless it's like a rookie catcher,
like if Dalton Rushing was catching Clayton Kershaw, which happened in you know, Kershaw's debut this year, like, sure, that seems like an exception.
But this is why it's interesting, because what happens when a base runner tries to steal second and they barely get thrown out? What do? They look to the dugout and they say, hey, we got to challenge that. Every player thinks they're safe, right? Everybody thinks so. But in those situations, you look to the dugout and it's on the manager to make the decision. I agree with you. In theory, there will be front offices and coaching staff will say, hey, pitchers, you're not allowed to challenge. I mean, you're telling me there aren't going to be pitchers that just go rogue and tap their head? Like, that's going to happen.
It's going to be great. I mean, it's going to be great. 100%.
Yeah. And that's compelling. But I think, just because I did want to give the numbers here, because at the end of March, MLB put out the, and there was a lot of interesting data in here, but this is what you're referring to. The pitching team had a 54% overturn rate, 54.4%, compared to the hitting team, which is just the hitter, to be clear, 50%. Coin flip. When the hitter challenged, it was a coin flip. Catchers succeeded at a 56% clip.
There you go.
41% for pitchers. Okay.
There you go.
So that's a huge difference in, like, so that is a thing that I totally agree with you that the teams are going to have to understand at the same time. And you can start to institute
fascinated
those rules,
to know the
training, but it's just not the same thing.
Dude, the pitch type breakdown, I'm sure is fascinating.
Sure.
I would say fastballs are probably easier to challenge.
Right.
Like, you're
what
more
if they're
successful?
Really fast, though.
They are fast. That's why they're.
I don't know. So there's so many parts with this, and there's so many different angles we could go to. But that's the thing that I just want to hit home about is just, like, if we're going to do this next year, they're going to test in spring training. To your point, I hope they have it in every park, but we really won't know. I think the adjustment for the pitch clock in spring training, I think, was easier over time. Not only because you had a lot of players that had already done in the minor leagues, but also that, like, that's more of just the rhythm of the sport. It's not. The strategy is not as much there. Maybe a little bit with the pickoffs, but I think that there's going to be so much more to adjust to here, even if it's a few pitches a game. So I'm interested in this. I am mostly pro, but I do think that there are some elements that I'm still a little uncomfortable with. But hey, Manfred wants to change a rule. That's generally what's going to happen. Let's take a break. And when we return, the other big bit of news involving the White Sox of Chicago. We'll be right back on Baseball Bar. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast, our second massive news of the week. involves the Southsiders. Jake, we need to talk about the White Sox.
Do we?
Yeah, we do. And not just because they split with the best team in baseball, the Detroit Tigers. Hello, the White Sox only won 3 games against the Tigers all of last season. They win 2 this week. And
normal,
oh
bad.
Boy, they are scorching hot. No, we're not going to talk about the team that much, though I do have a few thoughts at the end of this conversation. No, this is much bigger news than anything that is happening on field for the White Sox. And I know that White Sox fans feel the same way. As much as they love Chase Meidroth like me and Shane Smith and some of the good things happening on the farm. No. There is a big, big, big development in White Sox world that now, does this matter right this instant? Maybe not, but this is a big deal. Jerry Reinsdorf, who has owned the White Sox for 45 years.
Hell yeah, dude.
Has officially announced at least a path to no longer owning the White Sox. That is a huge deal. Now, who's the lucky guy that's going to be owning the White Sox after Jerry Reinsdorf? His name is Justin Ishbia. Justin Ishbia, the brother of Matt Ishbia, who is the owner of the Phoenix Suns. And for those NBA fans listening to this podcast, know that Matt Ishbia has had a rather dramatic and tumultuous beginning to his ownership of the Phoenix Suns. Justin also involved in that ownership group, but it seems like Justin really wanted to kind of do his own thing. And quietly, in the past few years, he bought a minority stake in Chicago White Sox. And then over the offseason, with the division rival Minnesota Twins for sale, and by the way, still for sale, it seemed like Justin Ishbia was interested in buying the Twins. And then at some point along the way, it was like, just kidding, Justin Ishbia is no longer involved because he's more interested in buying more of the White Sox. And apparently, basically with Jerry Reinsdorf's blessing, like even before this news this week, which is that as soon as 2029, Jerry Reinsdorf will have the option to sell the majority stake to Justin Ishbia. It seemed like Jerry Reinsdorf was like, hey, I'd rather you get more involved here than go buy the Twins and, you know, maybe make our life difficult here in the AL Central. So with all that in mind, this is pretty massive news. Now, the timing here is interesting, right? So the details are that from 2029 to 2033, Reinsdorf can sell the team, the majority, like he has the option to. 2034, it flips and Justin Ishbia can just buy it. He can just, if he wants to suddenly buy the White Sox and be in charge of the White Sox, he can do that. But they make very clear, they say nothing is changing until 2029. Like that is a big part of this announcement, is they're saying nothing is changing until 2029 other than Justin Ishbia infusing a bunch of cash to cover debt and start, you know, slowly running team operations. Here's the thing, Jake.
Yeah.
Jerry Reinsdorf's 89 years old.
What?
Respectfully. You know?
Respectfully 89 or?
Respectfully.
What you're saying is respectful.
Yes. I am saying that
respectfully.
It is not a surprise that at age 89, Jerry Reinsdorf has finally decided we should probably come up with some sort of plan to move on here. Sure. But it is also a weird thing to get massive news about, because normally when we have this owner that a lot of fans are tired of is selling the team, there's like a, here we go, we did it. But the fact that we do not know when this is going to happen over the next six or 7 years, and the fact that it could not happen until 2034 when like Hagen Smith is in his second year as a Dodger is like very kind of strange to process.
Yeah, dude. But he's like a young 89 though.
Yeah. For sure.
He's a spry 89. Yeah, also, that part's weird.
I'm realizing that means he's owned the White Sox for more years than he hasn't.
Correct. Roll the dice, flip a coin on the year. You know, chances are he owned the team. Here's a quote from Big Jimmy. What's like the nickname for Jerry? I guess it is Jerry. Gerald. Is it Gerald Reinsdorf? Yeah. Look that up for me while I say this. Quote, having the incredible. What do you say?
Yeah. I think it's just Jerry. I think birth name Jerry. I could be wrong, but.
Government name Jerry?
I don't know. Not Gerard like DePoto.
Having the incredible opportunity to own the Chicago White Sox and be part of Major League Baseball for nearly 50 years has been a life-changing experience. White Sox fans feel the same. Reinsdorf said in a statement, quote, I have always expressed my intent to operate the White Sox as long as I am able and remain committed to returning this franchise to the level of on-field success we all expect and desire. Well, my dude, 7 playoff appearances in 45 years is not exactly, you know, you have not established a track record of greatness, big guy.
But so yes, but what he's referring to there is like the current moment. And this is why I'm so interested in this story, because it is massive news. Jerry Reinsdorf finally saying, there is a path for me to not on the team.
But that's not really what he's saying.
But I mean, it is functionally, because this is like a legal agreement. But for this is the first time this has happened. It's the first time this has happened. That's why this is
news for the following reason. What Jerry Reinsdorf is saying here, I'm going to translate this for you, okay? Here's what he's saying. I, Jerry Reinsdorf, will one day die. That's what he's saying, okay? That is what this is. How many more years of cognizance does he have
this
left?
This is my point.
What he is doing here is creating the succession plan, right? And it's about so that he feels comfortable that when he's gone, the White Sox are in good hands, friendly hands, familiar hands.
We don't know.
Comfortable hands.
Jerry
could have sold this to a lot of people. He clearly sold this to Ishbia because he likes Ishbia or thinks Ishbia will do a good job or whatever. Like, that was the pick. He's making the pick, not someone else. That's important to Jerry Reinsdorf. He is lucky here that he has made this choice before he dies. A lot of people, most people, die before 89, you know? And I feel bad that some White Sox fans, in fact, will die before this ownership group changes hands, because the quickest it could change is 2029, right? And so my understanding of this whole dynamic is this is not necessarily like a day for celebration. It doesn't change anything functionally in the next couple of years. It just tells White Sox fans who the owner will be until like 2050, right? You know, the next person now.
And to really hammer that point home, I think, is to go back to that quote that you just read. I remain committed to returning the franchise to the level of on-field success we expect and desire. That is talking about right now, when they are still one of the worst teams in baseball. No longer as bad as last year. No longer the total joke of the league, right? We know has that title now. But he's still seeing, like, Jerry still believes that, like, he will be in charge when the White Sox are good again. And now, regardless of Jerry's age and health, and as he mentions, as long as he is able, whether or not that will happen before 2029, let's say Jerry's is doing great in 2029. If he's doing great and the White Sox are winning, guess what? Jerry's going to keep owning the team. Now, if the White Sox are still losing in 2029, very possible, considering how deep of a hole they are in, then, I mean, I don't know. Maybe he then finally decides, all right, your turn, Justin. But I agree with you. This feels that is why this is a strange bit of news. I don't know how to process it. And honestly, it shouldn't be us who are deciding, because White Sox fans have a lot of feelings about where the White Sox are now, where how they have gotten here, where they have been, which does include a World Series, but that was a long time ago. And how is this a day of great, or is it just like, all right, like, presumably you did have to hand it over at some point, and now we at least know who that's going to be?
I think Reinsdorf is in a very unique category of owner. Bad at the job. The track record speaks for itself. He has consistently not taken advantage of the market size he's in to build a consistent competitor. And most recently, he hijacked the rebuild to install Tony La Russa, which certainly did not have a positive impact. And there's an argument that if you make the right hire in that moment, those good White Sox teams maybe have a little bit more success, right?
Yeah.
I think it is interesting that Ishbia chose the White Sox over the Twins. I would like to talk about that now. Because there is something Metsy here, something Metsian about the White Sox, right? They are the little brother in the big market. Cubs are one, they're three, respectfully, right? Same thing happened with Yankees and Mets, you know? But there is a sleeping giant element to that because of the number of people that live in the place. And in the way, it's a little different for Steve Cohen, because Steve Cohen didn't buy the Mets because he saw a business opportunity. Clearly, he has sunk so much money into this thing. It is a passion project for him. But it is also a recognition that the Mets could be something different and special if you, and the White Sox have that too. And so I think if you're a White Sox fan, there is frustration of the fact that Reinsdorf will still be here until we get President Dwayne The Rock Johnson in 2028 or whatever. But there has to be a little bit of optimism baked into this because you were chosen over the Twins.
Yeah.
I now, think you were chosen point. Over, you know, the Astros now, or listen, like a team with rings. But the a smart business boy who is richer than all of us combined made a decision to buy the White Sox instead of the Twins because of the bones of the house.
I think yes. I think that's true. Clearly something has gone on with the Twins sale that has slowed things down, and it might just be the Twins owners, Polad's, asking for more money than Justin Ishbia wanted to give them. So there's absolutely just financial elements to all of this that I cannot speak to specifically. And I look forward to reading more reporting about this. I know that like Dan Hayes has had some great reporting about this during the Twin sale. And we're going to learn more about this. I think your macro point is fair. There are some other differences, right? Like the Ishbias are from Detroit. Like they're from Michigan. It's not like a grew up a White Sox fan, like a, you know, a Steve Cohen situation. But I think that there's has to be some level of truth to what you are kind of putting out there, which is that, yeah, I mean, that in some ways, yes, he was interested in buying the Twins. And then at some point he decided, no, I'd rather buy the White Sox. Now, he was already involved in the White Sox. So, but that is also all still very recent. So I think it is a fair point. And I am intrigued to see what this would, again, with the other new ownership changes, they've happened a lot faster. And so we've started to, we could then start to have conversations about like, what's Justin Ishbia going to be like as an owner? But like, it doesn't feel like worth our time to even do that at this stage. And so that is why this feels a little bit empty of a bit of news, because I would like to have that conversation, because when new owners come in, it is a compelling thing to follow, whether you are a White Sox fan or not. But yeah, let us know. White Sox fans, baseballbarbecast@gmail.com. How are you feeling about this?
Trivia time.
Yep.
I'm reading from Jerry Reinsdorf's Wikipedia page. Jerry Reinsdorf was born to a Jewish family in Brooklyn, New York. Hell yeah, brother. He is the son of a blank salesman. Okay? He is the son of a blank salesman. Jordan Schusterman. Do you think you could do this?
I don't know. I mean, I know this isn't like Jerry Reinsdorf did not come from money. He made his money later. This was not. So I don't think. And yeah, salesman doesn't necessarily suggest. I don't know. Tell me.
You ready? You ready? A, Jerry Reinsdorf is the son of a sewing machine salesman. B, he is the son of a potato salesman. C, he is the son of a Jewish book salesman. Or D, the son of a typewriter salesman. Sewing machine, potato, Jewish books, or typewriters. Jordan Schusterman, what did Jerry Reinsdorf's father sell in Brooklyn?
I am going to go with sewing machine.
Okay. That is correct.
I was between that and typewriter. Potatoes, that's really specific. I'm not sure anyone is only selling potatoes. I could be wrong. I guess maybe. but
what's your, at that what's stage, your pops
also,
do?
Also
what's
in, your pops in, do? In New York?
Yeah.
You're selling potatoes in Brooklyn?
He had them shipped in from Idaho direct.
Okay. All right. Anyway, the other thing
my
is
dad
just
like, goes door to door on Flatbush. Just,
just selling.
You want to russet?
The last thing I just want to say about the White Sox is that good for them. They're not that bad. Like, this was the goal. Through 63 games last year, they were 15-48 with a minus 152 run differential. This year, 20-43, minus 57. That's a normal bad team. It's a bad, I mean, it's a very bad team, right? On pace to win 51 games, very bad. And so, yes, our perception is completely warped because of last season. But good for
better.
Them. Like, they're fine. They're more watchable. We got Kyle Teals coming up now. Maybe we'll talk about him, you know, as he's kind of settles into the big leagues. Some players that we enjoy watching. Luis Robert hitting 170 is a disaster, but you know what? We'll be okay. So White Sox fans, let us know how you're feeling about the baseball team and about the future of the franchise. We're going to take a break. When we return, Jake, this is what you tuned in for. How did Jake play in the media game? That and Good, Bad, Ugly when we return on Baseball Barbecue. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It's time for the field report.
Field report, a lot of reporters on the field.
All right, Jake, explain. This, I feel like we must have talked about this last year.
I don't remember.
You didn't do it last year, and No. We were not podcasting in this form. So you've talked about this in some place somewhere before, but why don't you explain to folks what this is and how you played in this baseball game?
Okay, so every year, the Yankees and Red Sox media members do a game, a baseball game, a hardball game, two games, in fact.
The East Coast Bias Bowl.
It's the East Coast Bias Bowl, the big market showdown. Of, you know, and it takes 7 hours like a regular Sunday night baseball game. No, I'm just kidding. It is all the Yankees writers against all the Red Sox writers. They do one game on the field at Fenway and one game on the field at Yankee Stadium. It's usually on a Friday morning before a three-game set. The Yankees are hosting the Red Sox this weekend. All the Red Sox writers are here. First time this year those two teams are played, which is weird. I've played once before. I believe it was 2022 I played in Fenway. Had a great time. Schedule conflicts have made it difficult for me to make an appearance since then. I played very well in that game. I went 4-for-4 and caught. And so as one of the few people willing to squat, my services are much sought after. And so today I woke up, I bought a large jug of water, hopped on the train. It was delayed. So then I hopped on a city bike and went over to Yankee Stadium at 9 a.m. to play 3 hours of hardball against a bunch of other people who are not very skilled at this.
I mean, again, there's a million questions that I have and I'm sure other people have, but let's just cut to your performance. How many at bats?
Yeah.
How was your catching experience? What was the hardest pitch thrown? Now, I don't know if you want to name drop some of the other media folks that were involved. I'm sure some people will be familiar with them, but let's just focus on your performance.
So I caught 8 of the 9 innings behind the dish.
Played
took
nine.
One inning off.
Played 9 innings.
We got through 9, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Joe Lemire of Sports Business Journal was on the bump for New York. He brought a pocket radar and had someone behind the dish. He was sitting 6-8, touching 9, dude. Now that's
6-8.
That's with sevens in front.
I was going to guess 6, so that's pretty good.
Very impressive. He was good. And then Tyler Kepner threw a couple innings of The Athletic. Slower.
He was throwing
register.
Softer than that.
Much softer than that, respectfully.
Okay. That's fine for you. You're catching.
Yes. The New Yorkers won, I believe, 14-2, 15-2. Oh. Really laid it on thick. Some rough defense.
Appropriate for this season. Appropriate for this
very
season.
Appropriate. Yeah. Some rough defense from the Beantown side. From the
also
the
appropriate
Boston nine, also
leading
the
team, leading
season.
The league in errors, of course.
Not great.
I'm sorry. It is a great thing where it's like these are the people. Again, these are people that we like and respect and appreciate.
Sure,
this is nothing against them, but like their job is to like ask Alex Cora why they're making so many errors,
and then they're making errors. Now the Red Sox also had a couple PR people playing for them, is common, just because. You know, you need bodies and a couple of good guys. One of them will come back up later here in a second. I hit 5th. And my first at bat in the first inning, I went down looking. And I am embarrassed by that. I fouled off, I believe, 4 or 5 pitches in an 0-2 count.
Oh, okay. So you battled and then you just...
Yeah, I just took a fastball in the inner half. It was a couple balls off. This may shock you. The zone is a little larger in the media game than in real life.
I'm sorry.
As it should be. And I told the umpire when I came back out the next half, I was like, look, that was off the plate.
No. You said, good I call. Checked it on the iPad. It was a ball, but I get it.
I should have tapped.
You should have tapped.
Second at bat, I made magic happen. All right. So the number one thing in hitting, okay, the number one thing about hitting, when you haven't hit in a while, is your what?
Your timing?
Your timing is always late.
Late.
You're late on everything. Bad. Your timing is bad, but you're never too early, right? No one has ever taken a lot of time away from baseball and been like, man, I'm so early. Everyone is late. And one of the funniest parts of this game is like a lefty walks up to the plate and all the fielders shade to the pull side. And it's like, guys, no, other way. Like everyone is hitting an oppo because everyone's late. And so when I like to play one game a year, still, to remind myself that I still got a little bit of skill in the tank, right? And I was a pitcher in college. But my cue for hitting is go get the baseball before you think you need to, because otherwise you'll just be fouling balls off to the third baseline. And I caught I believe a 1-1 heater out in front on the front leg, went and got it and drove it down the line in right with some elevation and short hopped the Yankee Stadium fence. It was in the air for long enough that there was legitimate tension about whether it was going to get out. Okay. You know, you could see in the video, you got people on the top step, you know, peering out.
True.
Like, oh, did he get it?
They were. That's true. You can see on the video. There was a moment of like, no way. Did someone?
There was a moment of no way. If you see me,
I'm curious about the history of home runs in this media game.
Max Goodman hit a ball off the wall a couple years ago. Someone homered way back in like,
yeah, it must have happened at least once, but sure.
It's a legend. But I cranked it. You know, like if I had elevated a little bit more, I think it could have gotten out. I really did hit the snot out of the thing. And if you watch, like, I look at it for a second, because my first thought is, that's the furthest I've hit a baseball in 15 years, 10 years. And so I'm just like, that's got to be out of here, because it's out in most places, which is hilarious because it's the shortest right field in the world.
Right. Sorry. You should clarify what most places means.
Most places that I played.
Okay. Thank you. So a little different.
Also,
what a surprise. Even the smallest big league parks are bigger than all the other ones.
The irony here is that because I hit it down the line, I think it could have been out at Fenway. Like Sedan Rafaela walk-off homer.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, I get on my horse.
Yeah,
and
you're
I'm
going.
Cooking around the bases. Stand-up triple. Ball comes into the cutoff man, and they're not paying attention. Okay? In this program, we take extra bases when they're handed to us. Okay? And so I ran home, and I slid it. I was safe. And my wife said, you hit a home run. And I was like,
oh, kinda. Hell yeah.
Kind of did.
Did it for you, wife.
I hit a ball near the wall, and then
listen,
I scored.
Let's keep it simple. Jake, extra base hit. Fact. Indisputable. There's no, however you want to describe exactly where you ended up, whether it was a double, whether it was a triple, would it have been a triple with Aaron Judge playing right field? Probably not.
No.
But, you know, it's probably a double. You know,
now,
probably not a home run. So
I
good for you.
Sent
you
this
got
video.
The same, yeah,
sent this video to a member of the New York Yankees, friend of the program, Carlos Rodon. Yep. Jordan, can you read what Carlos replied?
I won't read what you said, but he did say barrel. Just one word, barrel.
Barrel.
Carlos knows. I mean, Carlos hasn't allowed a lot of barrels this year. So.
He has in the past.
He
knows
has in the past. He does know what it looks like. He's probably allowed. He's allowed some doubles into that corner for sure.
100%. Sure. Who hasn't? Anyway, it's one shining moment type stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
This and here's what's kind of sad. That's the best I'm going to hit a baseball the rest of my life. Like, I'm...
Probably. Yeah,
I don't think I'll hit a ball that good again.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, if I had asked you this morning, like, what's going to be... You probably didn't think You already exceeded your expectations, so maybe why not do it again next year?
I mean,
we'll see.
Yeah, like you give me an off season with Teacher Man or you know any of these.
Elevate hitting. A little more, just, you know, get some,
a little more loft. Got to get in the back hip. This is the thing. You watch big league hitters, and you're like, wow, what? That's the best guys are so simple, right?
Right.
Like they're very. It's easy. It's not complicated. You know why? You know why? Because they're so strong. Like Aaron Judge can just touch the ball and it goes over the fence. I have to swing with every last fiber in my body to get it to go off the bat hard because I'm a weak boy. Yeah. I had two more at bats. One of them, fastball in on my hands, rolled over to first, gave a really strong 90, but I was out on a 4-3. And then scary moment in the last at bat.
Comebacker?
Laser. Like, I think exit velo on this maybe harder than the other by it. Laser right at the pitcher, Red Sox PR guy. Okay. He snags it, Jose Fernandez Tulo style, like just right in the glove, like a thud crack.
What a beast.
Whoa. And I'm so happy he caught it because I would not have gotten any access to any Red Sox for the rest of my life if I sent a Red Sox PR guy to the hospital.
Yeah. That's bad. That's awesome. Congratulations on your 1-for-4. I mean,
yeah, but the slugging percentage is. And I got to say, look, catcher is a tertiary position group, right?
That's true. 1-for-4 with an extra base hit as a catcher is. We love that.
Yeah, like we'll take that. We'll take that all day long. And I hit another hard hit ball. But, you know, there's so many funny things about
your
this experience.
Your ex-woba is.
It's through the roof. You got to come because anytime there's a fly ball, everyone's like, oh my God, it's gone. And then it's like, that's a fly out. Like, we suck.
Also appropriate for Yankee Stadium. So,
anyway, thanks for letting me
that's
yap
awesome,
about that. I had a great time.
No, that's great. Congrats. You and Pablo Reyes have the same number of extra base hits. All right, it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly. Something good, something bad, something ugly from the past week in baseball. Jake Mintz, take it away. Something good.
This is great. Max Scherzer throwing a live bullpen in Toronto this week as he returns from injury.
I love this.
He warms up, catches the ball, puts his head down, and he's ready to throw. And he looks up, and who's in the box? Kyle Schwarber. Kyle Schwarber, who was his teammate with the Nats in 2021, which is hilariously weird to think about, right? They just don't, just never feels like they overlap. But they're pals because, duh, Kyle Schwarber's pals with everyone. And it was great to see Scherzer's reaction of Schwarber getting in the box. Schwarber must have been in, you know, taking live BP early, or I don't know if he planned this, but he was wearing a uniform, full gear, helmet, the bat, everything. Great bit. Baseball dudes doing a good bit on camera. We love a good bit. Great job, Kyle Schwarber. Max Scherzer was like, get out of here. And then everyone laughed. You also see all the Blue Jays players behind the net giggling. Good. Good job. No notes. Good job, everyone.
This was also so funny because, to your point, like, and we talked about live BP with Otani. We've talked about these normally happen so much earlier than BP. So I do commend Kyle Schwarber here because he was clearly committed to get into full uniform and do this hours and hours before the game.
All over Kyle it. Schwarber.
My good this week is the softball and the baseball. College sports rolls on. And while my bad is also college baseball related, I just want to urge people, watch Game 3. Texas Tech, tonight, Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. It should be great. The first two games have been very chaotic and very weird and some moments we've never seen before. But Kennedy got the job done, even with the Texas rally last night. And then the Division I Baseball Super Regionals are this weekend. And that is also one of the most fun weekends of baseball that we have. So I encourage everyone to check those out when we find out who is going to Omaha. Let's go to the bad, Jake. What you got?
The Braves.
Oh. Whew. Whew. Dude.
And that's it.
I mean, think about this. Think about this. We had this conversation on Wednesday.
I love when this happens.
Braves?
I love when this happens.
Stuff happening over there. Yeah.
We spent some time on the team and we're like, things are going terribly over there. And then the team will like win two games in a row and we look stupid. I love when we're like, this team's, something's weird here. And then they just have a like all-time catastrophe. The Braves are winning 10-4, headed into the top of the ninth at home on a getaway day against the Arizona Snakebacks. Into the game comes Scott Blewett. He does. I feel bad for Scott Blewett. He's actually like not that terrible. Like he's a totally fine fill-in back-end reliever. If his name was Scott, you know, Schmaltz or Herfenderfer or Johnson, no one would care.
Well, as I said, I texted our Braves fan friend, Foolish Baseball, I said, should have signed Scott Slam the Door because this is not what happened. Scott Blewett's been getting these jokes for years. This was the most... this is the first time I've seen Scott blow it, though. Now, it wasn't just him.
Yeah, and then in after Scott Blewett comes Rice L. Iglesias, who cannot
so bad
get out of it. He was one of the best closers in baseball last year. I just want to quickly... May I? This is one of my favorite things. This is the top of the ninth inning.
Give me that.
The
Give
Arizona
me that.
Give Diamondbacks.
Me that at-bat by at-bat.
Gino Suarez strikes out swinging. Hey, we got one. Got one.
We got one. We're up by six. What's the big deal?
Lourdes Gurriel homers. Fly ball to left field. Hey,
Uh-oh.
We're good. That's fine.
Uh-oh.
No worries. Still, Tim Tawa, the terrible Tawa. He walks, moves to second on defensive indifference. Should have been different.
Oh.
Alec Thomas homers. Three-run game.
Uh-oh.
Hey, flush it. Flush it.
Hey, rally killer, though. We killed rally the momentum. Killer. We gave him a home run.
You know, it's a rally resuscitator. Jose Herrera walks, and in comes Rice L. Iglesias for Scott Blewett. And at this point, Diamondbacks are like, you know, it's good to get the closer in the game. Like, you know,
true,
fought at the end. Love to see that fight from our guys. Like, good series in Atlanta, whatever. Corbin Carroll, though, good player. Double. Second to third. Ketel Marte, single. 10-8. Geraldo Perdomo pops out to shortstop. Oh, 10-8. Yeah, we got two.
Two down. Still up
got
by two.
Two. Hey, got two. Ildemaro Vargas, who 2 weeks ago was interfering with AAA baseball. Singles on a line drive to cut the lead to one. Corbin Carroll scores. Gino Suarez, who struck out to start the inning. He's up. Two-run double. Diamondbacks take the lead. Amazing. Gurriel walk. Tim Tawa line out. Good job, Braves. You know what'll fix that is calling up Craig Kimbrell. They did do that. He is now with the team. I believe they got rid of Scott Blewett as the corresponding. But everything's fine in Atlanta. Don't think too hard about it.
I'm very excited to watch Kimbrell. How many saves for Craig Kimbrell this season? Over, under 3.5?
Over.
Yeah. Over, under 9.5?
Over.
Okay, Iglesias just... He's just totally cooked.
All right. Braves head to San Francisco. Dude, they had to sit on the plane from Atlanta to San Francisco with this loss.
It's the opposite of a happy flight.
Oh.
My bad this week is the transfer portal. Now,
so
it's not really fair because this is not about the portal itself because, you know, kids are doing what's best for them. Everyone is generally acting rationally under the guidelines of the NCAA. However, this sucks. This tweet from East Carolina head coach Cliff Godwin, who his team was just eliminated this past weekend, he tweeted, "Our system is so broken. We have coaches at Power Four schools texting our players directly who are not in the portal, and we have proof." This is something we've been hearing about for the last couple years. I hate this for so many reasons. Not just that, like, players are being poached from schools, they're not even in the portal, like, I just don't want to be thinking about this right now. If we want to do college baseball free agency offseason when the Omaha's done, fine. If that's the world we're going to live in, great. Player movement is interesting, whether it's college, whether it's pro. There's problems with it. There's good things with it. That's a different conversation. But the timing of this, all I want to do is think about postseason baseball and the teams that are still playing, sucks. And I don't know how it's going to change, but I hope it does in some way because it is very, very unpleasant. Part of the sport is this timing, even though, again, it all makes sense for the people involved. It sucks. What's Ugla?
Rockies, good week.
Hell yeah, dude.
Peace. Hell yeah. Rocks are hot. O's are hot. Taking three from the M's. O's on that W6. Tony Mancelino. Mancelino. Oh! Anyway, but I'm talking about the Rockies. This is a tweet from Patrick Lyons, who covers the Rockies.
Shout out, Patrick, friend of the pod.
This is an amazing tweet. Rockies' Ezekiel Tovar exited the game in the bottom of the eighth. Manager Warren Schaefer said Tovar, quote, felt something in his body.
Well, thankfully it wasn't anything too serious because I believe he played the next game, but
something in his body, a tapeworm?
like what was communicated to Warren Schaefer, I guess would be the question.
It feels like it was not communicated to Warren Schaefer.
Right. But that feels like a pretty standard question. Why did Tovar leave the game? He's like, I don't know, man. Something going on. Yeah, not great. Don't
What's that song? I can feel it in my body.
I guess the question is, was Warren Schaefer hiding something or did he not know? That's really, I guess, the question. I'll text Patrick. So this was like a genuine best answer he could give.
Hey, Tovar left the game in the bottom of the eighth. Everything okay? Yeah, he felt something in his body. It's like, wait.
Well, they do that in hockey,
as opposed
right?
to what?
Upper like, body, lower body.
Felt something in his soul. He didn't want to be on the Rockies anymore.
He was feeling some internal strife.
Felt something else.
He could not play shortstop any longer.
I'm going to say that all the time. Funny. Are you sick? Yeah, I feel something in my body.
They're like, all right, well, guess you're done. Guess you're done for the day.
What's up with him?
All right.
Oh, he's got one of the body feels.
My Ugla is also injury related. Francisco Lindor was hit by a pitch. Tony Gonsolin plunked him. Now, is it a plunk? I guess it's still a plunk. Plunk doesn't necessarily dictate where you got hit. Love the word plunk. Anyway, broke his toe. Very strange. It is Ugla by itself, the fact that Mookie Betts breaks his toe going to the bathroom in the dark. And then Francisco Lindor, what is this revenge? Tony Gonsolin's like, I will stand up for Mookie's toe and I will hurt your best player's toe.
Gonsolin should have thrown at the dresser that hurt Mookie.
Exactly. They should have like wheeled like a nightstand out in between the bases when Francisco Lindor was, or like in the hallway, like, you know, in the clubhouse, they try to catch him.
Got him.
Turn the lights off and just have the Mets wander around in the dark until someone breaks their toe. Anyway, my Ugla is about what Gary Cohen said after Francisco Lindor got hit by this pitch. He said, and the Mets continue to get hit at a prodigious rate. I was like, wow, that's a pretty dramatic thing to say. Then I remembered, like, yeah, the Mets do get hit by a lot of pitches. This was a big storyline a few years ago when the Mets set the record for most hit by pitches in the modern era. They were hit 112 times in the 2022 season. But what if I told you that their record was immediately broken? In fact, almost broken the year after by the Seattle Mariners in 2023. They had 111. And then last year, the Mariners set the record, 116 hit by pitches. Then I was like, okay, well, what about this year? Mets. They are in first place. They're tied with the Twins for most hit by pitches in baseball. 41, I believe, in 62-63 games. Not on pace to set a record again. So I'm not saying sure they are still at a prodigious rate, although they were hit a lot in 2023. But it just gives me another reason to bring up Ty France, because Ty France is the link here. Ty France, who is the hit-by-pitch superhero, has carried that over to Minnesota and has already been hit 11 times. He was, of course, a huge part of the Mariners being hit by a ton of pitches in 2023 and 2024 and whenever else Ty France is on the team. And I hope Ty France is doing okay. I know he's used to this, but to do it also on the Twins, to be a hit-by-pitch guy on the Twins, the team that gets injured all the time, feels like a dangerous combination, but Ty France is still cooking. So anyway,
it's like, do not teach this strategy to Byron or to Royce or Buxton to Carlos. Just keep this yourself. Yeah. Thank you.
But I just want to keep it again. It's a good rate, but I don't know if, sorry, Gary Cohen, you are one of the best in the business. Prodigious is a bit of a stretch at this stage.
Do you know who has the all-time record for hit by pitches?
For an individual. Well, this is a whole, this could career. Be its own Ugla on its own. It's Huey Jennings.
No. I mean, well, single season, yeah. Career Huey is Jennings, Biggio.
Oh, Biggio for a career, yes. Well, Huey Jennings is Huey Jennings probably deserves his own Ugla at some point. But I'm going to save it because we've gone long and we need to end this podcast.
Goodbye.
Thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. I know we said we would do emails today, but we had some
lied to, you.
To cover. We will get to it very soon. Enjoy the baseball this weekend. We are not going to preview it. We are going to review it because that's what we do on Mondays. So we will talk to you next week. Thank you to Andrew Hartz. Thank you to TJ Brassel for producing. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for telling us about your incredible double, triple, homer, question mark, down the line at Yankee Stadium. We will talk to you all next week, everybody. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.